Welcome to the KPMG Financial Reporting Podcast, this time focused on financial reporting for impairments of non-financial assets. Listen to KPMG professionals discuss key points on these complicated areas.
Hello, I'm Karen Silverman, a partner at KPMG. And in this podcast, I'm visiting with two of my colleagues in the firm's Department of Professional Practice, Julie Santoro and Frederick Bort. Julie and Frederick are going to share with us their top 10 list of considerations related to impairment of non-financial assets for this year. Julie and Frederick, I'm really excited to hear your list today.
Thank you, Karen. We are excited to go through with this list with you today.
Fantastic. KPMG hosted our 30th Annual Accounting and Financial Reporting Symposium in November of 2020. One of the breakout sessions focused on this topic, and in that breakout, 52% of respondents said that COVID-19 was or could be an impairment triggering event in 2020. So this is clearly top of mind for many companies right now. Frederick, before we get started on your list, can you take us through a bit of background on impairment and how this list was developed?
Sure, Karen. So this is our personal top list based on what we are seeing and what we're being asked. Obviously, the items can be different for each company given their specific circumstances, but we do see some overall broad patterns. The one item that underlies our top 10 list, and that also is the key driver for the answer of the symposium question, is the significant uncertainty in the marketplace and the general economy that COVID-19 has brought. I mean, we hear and we also use the term unprecedented a lot this year. And while often in the past, this has been a much overused term, I think for the situation we are currently going through, it is a rather good description.
Yeah, I agree that unprecedented seems like an accurate term. Thanks for that background. I think that helps level set everyone as we delve deeper into this topic. Okay, so without further ado, let's get started on your list. The first step in an impairment journey is determining when to test for impairment. Julie, do you want to start the list with considerations associated with when companies should perform that test?
Sure, Karen. And we actually have two items that we put in our top 10 for when to test. So the first one is testing is not one and done. And what that really means is you have to look for potential impairment triggers throughout the year. This is not something that you just do once and then you leave. So if you had an impairment loss earlier this year in 2020, you still got to have a look and see if you have any indicators of impairment as we head towards the year end. So that's the first message in our list. And the second one is very particular to the current circumstances we find ourselves in. And it's a warning about internal reorganizations and the impact that can have on impairment testing. So we all know a reorganization can be physical, moving, you know, how you handle your physical assets, but it can also be organizational. And sometimes when you have these changes in the organization, who is reporting to whom, you can have a change in your reporting units. When that happens, goodwill gets reassigned to the different reporting units, the new ones, based on relative fair values. But the real risk here is that there is an impairment loss being masked. And so generally, there is an expectation that you have this kind of reorganization. There will be impairment testing done before and after the reorganization, and if necessary, an impairment loss will be booked. So Karen, those are my first two points.
That's great advice. In both the symposium results and in the comments you just made, you talked about triggering events. How should a company go about identifying those events? What should they be looking out for?
It's about taking into account all of the different factors in the economy, what's happening with COVID-19, how that's playing out for your particular company, looking at all those facts and circumstances in their entirety, working through them and really saying to yourself, based on the weight of how I am being affected, do I have an indication that my goodwill is more likely than not impaired from a goodwill point of view, or otherwise, is it looking like I have an impairment of my assets?
Thanks, Julie. That's helpful clarification. So now that a company has determined that they need to perform a test, there are several factors they would need to consider. So let's start with considerations related to testing goodwill for impairment. The process involves estimating the fair value of the company's reporting units. In the symposium, we asked participants to identify the single most challenging aspect of testing goodwill for impairment. 46% of them indicated that it's preparing cash flow forecasts and applying the income approach to measure fair value. Frederick, given that this seems to be a challenge for many companies, can you share with us your list of considerations related to goodwill impairment and specifically cash flow projections?
Sure. So preparing cash flow forecasts is not easy, even in normal times. So companies having to do this in this year with all the uncertainty is a much more challenging task. And once the discussion turns to the uncertainty, one item that will always come up is that people will recall that the discount rate can be one place to deal with risk and uncertainty, and it generally feels much easier to make a single adjustment to the discount rate and not to have to tackle the uncertainty in the cash flows themselves. And while this is not wrong, I find that is not the best approach. And here is why. If you include any risk premium in your discount rate, and most often you see these referred to as company-specific risk premiums, you will need to be able to support that number. The approach we see most often is that when you derive a discount rate, it's based on a capital asset pricing model and the weighted average cost of capital, or WACC. One key component there is the cost of equity, and while valuation professionals and companies are really good at supporting all of the components of the cost of equity, there's always one that is very judgmental. This is the company-specific risk premium. And if you allow me to put my audit hat on for a moment, you will have to have a comparable level of support for the company-specific risk premium than for all your other elements. In most cases, that means that you will need to be able to explain the company-specific risk premium, not just qualitatively, but quantitatively. This is hard to do. One way of supporting it is to create a scenario of your forecast that eliminates the need for a company-specific risk premium, and then compare this scenario to your baseline cash flow forecast to assess if this makes sense. And this brings us to the second point I want to make on the topic of preparing cash flows. Right now, we see a lot of companies considering multiple scenarios, and we actually do recommend that to companies consider probability-weighted cash flows instead of just creating a single scenario. And now I can hear you think, hang on a second, your survey indicates that preparing cash flows is the hardest thing to do, and now we are asking them to prepare multiple versions thereof? Now, the good thing about scenarios is that it actually makes forecasting easier. In the current situation, most companies have a pretty good idea what their business should look like once things return to normal. The question, however, is how are we going to get there and how long will it take? And this is where the scenarios can come in. If you try to take all this into account in a single set of forecasts, it's really hard to do. But if you build out different scenarios with the recovery paths, and we hear a lot about a V, U, L, W, or other kind of shape recovery, and a timeline, then you have a good basis set for different scenarios. So arguably, yes, it is work, but I think it's easier to actually do scenarios that you can tailor than trying to fit all of that information into a single item.
Yeah, Frederick, I think that makes a lot of sense. Just maybe putting your auditor hat back on for a second, I would think if you're doing a probability weighting of cash flows, it would also be important to support how you determined which probability you applied to each of the scenarios. Is that right?
That is true, and I think it's one of the key challenges. The good thing is there is a lot of information currently out there about how different economists think about the different recovery paths. So you can actually use information in the marketplace that says, oh, here's the likelihood of a V-shaped or a U-shaped or a L-shaped recovery. And that is like one potential sources to put weightings to your different scenarios if it is these recovery pathways that you model out in the scenarios.
Oh, that's definitely helpful that third-party information is available to help support those judgments. So what else do you have on your list for goodwill?
So there's two more items. The first one is that if you use multiple valuation approaches, the weightings to arrive at your fair value conclusion must be appropriate. And the one thing to remember here is that appropriate does not mean they need to be the same as in the prior year. Earlier this year, for example, especially for valuation done in support of March 31st impairment tests, a lot of the data that we use in the market approach was not readily available, or it was stale because companies withdrew their earnings guidance, analysts didn't have a chance to reassess the situation and provide new forecasts. So if you were deriving multiples for a market approach, the data that you would need was either stale or not particularly reliable. So what we have seen and what we have done ourselves is essentially reduce the weight of the market approach and put more weight on the income approach. So in short, while consistency over time does have a certain importance, it is more important to make sure that the weightings are appropriate for the specific situation and time of your measurement, and they should be adjusted accordingly. Either way, you will need to have solid documentation regardless of whether you have changed your weightings or whether or not they are the same as in the prior year. And another hot topic is the market cap reconciliation. Now, this only applies to public companies. And what we do in a market cap reconciliation is we look at the traded share price for all of the outstanding shares, add that to the fair value of debt, and compare that to the sum of the parts of the value of all of the reporting units. Now, often what we see is that the sum of the parts will exceed the market cap. Now, what you shouldn't just do in a situation like this is that you cannot simply ascribe this to a control premium and call it a day. You need to do a detailed analysis of what are the drivers for this difference, and you need to have robust documentation to substantiate your control premium.
Yeah, I've absolutely seen in practice that the market capitalization reconciliation is more challenging than it may seem on its face. When companies perform this exercise, is it appropriate for them to use an averaging period? And if they do, can they use values obtained after the date of the impairment test?
This is a very common question. So to answer the first part, yes, it is okay to use a reasonable period of time to averaging, but generally before and up to the measurement date for the market cap reconciliation. Keep in mind, we do this to smooth out volatility, and the averaging should not be used to hide a sustained decline in share price. So earlier this year, we were talking probably days, not weeks, for a September 30 impairment test. The period might be longer, but you should not use dates in October in your analysis.
Yeah, understood. I think with the volatility in the stock market this year, the averaging could be important for companies to consider. So I think, Frederick, there was one more item in goodwill that we wanted to cover.
Sure, and I think the last one would be that you need to consider that sometimes goodwill is tax deductible. And if you have tax deductible goodwill, you need to take this into account. Now, this can throw a bit of a curveball into the goodwill impairment test analysis, as that means that once you're done with your fair value assessment and you determined the initial impairment amount based on the difference between your fair value of the reporting unit and the carrying amount of reporting unit, you are not quite done. In such a scenario, there's a second step needed, as the carrying amount of the reporting unit includes deferred tax items, and those will change when the amount of tax-deductible goodwill changes.
That definitely adds some additional complexity to the calculation. Julie, could you help us understand the accounting implications of the tax deductibility of goodwill?
Yeah, so basically what's going to happen, as Frederick said, you're going to come up with your impairment loss. The problem is, if you have tax-deductible goodwill, that when you book the accounting entries, you may, for example, that may increase your deferred tax asset that you've recognized. It may decrease the deferred tax liability. And when you book those entries, that is going to increase the carrying amount of your reporting unit. So once that increases, you've kind of created another impairment loss because you've gone back above your fair value. And that can go on and on. So you kind of have this never-ending loop of working out your impairment loss. So what we do under the standards is we actually do a simultaneous equation to actually work out what is the deferred tax adjustment and what is the final goodwill impairment loss? This is actually a really complex area. If you just have the flag that you know you've got to look at it, we have a lot more guidance about the complexities in our handbook on impairment.
Good. It sounds like that additional guidance would be helpful if a company is dealing with those challenges. Thanks to both of you for taking us through those considerations for goodwill. Now, let's go through some considerations for long-lived assets. In the symposium, we asked participants to identify the single greatest challenge in the recoverability test. 39% of respondents indicated it's knowing what cash flows to include in the recoverability test. Julie, it looks like cash flows are a challenge when it comes to long-lived assets as well. Can you take us through your list for this topic?
Yeah, so I guess all of what Frederick was discussing, or a lot of it, about estimating your cash flows, about looking at probability-weighted cash flows and scenario analysis versus doing single estimate, all of that applies equally if we're looking at our recoverability test for long-lived assets. So basically, all of that holds true. But then if we look at a couple of points that are very specific to asset groups and long-lived assets, like the first question is about how you do your testing. So the question is, if you have a single asset and you know for that asset that its fair value has dropped below its carrying amount, do you immediately have to write it down to its fair value? So if we're assuming we're in a held and used model, these are not assets that are being sold, these are ones we're using in the business, the answer is no, you don't do an immediate write down. That basically all of our testing is done in asset groups. So if you're confident that you have got the correct asset groups, you look at the fair value, or you look at the recoverability of that asset group as a whole to, in terms of looking at your impairment write down. If, however, at the end of the day, you've done all of that, you've done your recoverability test, you had a problem, you've done the fair value calculation, and you need to write down the asset group, we do it proportionate to the long-lived assets in that asset group. However, if there is an asset in there where we know its fair value, we don't actually take a write down of that asset below. And so there's kind of a floor on how much of an impairment loss we allocate to each asset. And I think the thing that people think in their minds is, well, okay, I don't know these fair values of these individual assets, so does it matter? And the standard actually requires us to know those fair values as long as we can do it without undue cost and effort. And the point I want to make here is that's a pretty high barrier to overcome. So don't look at it and assume, oh, no problem, I don't know, it's, you know, I don't have to worry about it. You do need to worry about it. You need to really think about that in terms of what those fair values could be. So I guess that's the first general point. And the second point in asset groups, which is the single most popular question coming in at the moment, is really right of use assets that have been recognized for companies that have adopted Topic 842 and the new leases standard. So we've got our ROU assets on the balance sheet, and a lot of questions about coming into the impairment of those. But it's coming back to those general principles. They get tested in the asset group. Depending on the actions that have been taken around those leased assets, there may be a need to reassess those asset groups. Perhaps you have changed how you are using them in the business. They may have been subleased. That may cause you to relook at what your asset groups are. At the end of the day, though, that caveat, that floor I spoke about, not writing down below the fair value of an individual asset, that applies as well. So when you are doing your allocation, don't assume that the value of a right of use asset is zero. It is typically not going to be zero. So all the general stuff applies, but be very wary with your right of use assets because there are a lot of questions about them, Karen.
Yeah, I could see how that would be a hot topic in the current environment, especially with all the news reports about companies asking for rent deferrals and other concessions. The leasing standard's also only a couple years old, so this may be the first time that companies are going through this type of evaluation in an economic downturn. Well, thanks so much, Julie, for the discussion of those items. One other topic we always want to cover is disclosures. Can you round out your top 10 list with a final item on disclosure considerations?
Sure, yeah. We felt that we couldn't have a top 10 and not having disclosures in it. The key takeaway that we want everybody to think about is, yes, you've got individual standards, you've got individual regulatory requirements that will say specifically what disclosures you need. But overall, the message to take away is those disclosures have to be fit for purpose. We expect them to be transparent and robust. And I guess the bottom line is, and this is really what we see the SEC looking at, is are you making statements that are going to mislead your investors? So you want to be very careful and looking at exactly what you're saying, and just making sure that you have got the appropriate disclosures for investors.
Great. Thanks again, Julie and Frederick. It's an excellent list, and you've given our listeners a lot to consider. Before we wrap up today, do you have any other suggestions of areas of focus for companies?
Sure, if I can chime in here. I think the key message is that companies need to plan ahead, especially if they are used to doing a goodwill impairment test based on a qualitative assessment that is often called a step zero, because this might not work in the current environment. In addition, I think it makes sense to discuss this topic early on with your auditor and, as needed, reach out to your advisor for support. And then we do have several publications that are very helpful on our website.
Thanks, Frederick. One last question for you, Julie. This is a complex topic and is especially difficult for private companies to implement. In the symposium, 43% of respondents would like to see an option to amortize goodwill on a straight line basis, with impairment testing only when there's a triggering event. Is there anything on the FASB's agenda related to this topic? Is help on the way for those companies?
Yeah, so very interestingly, when we posed that question to our symposium participants, really we were getting at the FASB's project on the subsequent measure of goodwill. And as we stand here now, it looks like there is momentum toward an amortization model with trigger-based testing. However, much more exciting and near term for private companies and not-for-profits, the FASB released an exposure draft toward the end of December that makes a major simplification for trigger-based impairment testing. And so if we go back to my first point I made at the start of this podcast about that need to monitor triggering events right throughout the year, under these proposals, that would go away for private companies and not-for-profits. If you are in scope and if you only do annual reporting. So I would say this is definitely one to watch. Comments are due January 20 to the FASB, and we expect fairly quick turnaround on this proposal.
Thanks for that update, Julie. That seems like welcome news for many private companies.
I recommend that you go to our website, kpmg.frv.us. You will find there an in-depth handbook on the impairment of non-financial assets. And if you're looking for a refresher about all of these impairment models, we have a webcast replay in there that does have CPE.
Thanks so much for your time today, Julie and Frederick. I know I learned a lot about some key impairment considerations for this year. One of the challenges I've seen in practice is the reconciliation to market capitalization. So I found that section particularly interesting. I also think the information on the ROU asset hot topic was helpful. Thanks to both of you for taking some time to have a chat with me today.
Thanks for listening to the KPMG Financial Reporting Podcast. For our handbook on the impairment of non-financial assets and a replay of our webcast on this topic, please go to our website, kpmg.frv.us.